Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Roxette, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. We've been meaning to do this recording with you for quite some time. We've done quite a few events together when you were still in the venture world, and you've had quite a successful career transition as well, which I definitely want to talk a little bit further about on this show. So before we do that, maybe if you could just share with the listeners a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background, and then we'll go from there.
Perfect. Well, thank you for having me, John. So I'm born and raised in Miami. I started in tech back in 2016, working at a medical device company, and then later a co-working software hardware company that got acquired. During that time, I decided to launch an accelerator chapter here in Florida, that focused on pre-seed and idea stage founders focused on tech verticals, fully agnostic. So I got to work with folks that were working on different verticals, whether that was like robotics, B2B software, health tech, climate tech, you name it. I ended up getting very focused in the blockchain, crypto, Web3 space. And then during that time, I transitioned from a Fortune 500 role into an incubator space in Wynwood called the Lab Miami. So I was a managing director and partner there until we sold the company back in 2023. My partner and I decided to launch a syndicate network. And that actually came out of the fact that we were doing pitch competitions since 2018 between New York and Miami. And these events were solely focused on founders learning to pitch investors. And in the audience, it was a mix of, C-level folks, tech founders, and of course, the VCs and investors that would come and look at deals that would come in through first. A lot of those founders, we got them really early, and a lot of them got to raise their rounds. So, my partner and I were doing a lot of venture partners with a lot of angel networks, and now we both sit on some angel networks. We're currently transitioning from the tech life into what we call the more stable, boring businesses. A lot of the investments we've done that have been very successful and profitable are not in tech, which is, crazy for someone who's been in tech since like 2016. But right now we're kind of exploring the world of roll-up strategies and PE for the foreseeable future.
Wow, that's super exciting. I definitely want to dive a little bit deeper into that. So maybe, if you could share a little bit more around, obviously coming from the tech background and entrepreneurial, background that you have, going into, the startup space and then, making actually investments on the venture side, I'm in that full time, and that's my day job. That's what I do day in and day out, and it's, as one of the riskiest categories in just the overall asset management and from the investment standpoint. What was the motivation behind kind of just maybe even thought process around shifting towards more traditional, maybe private equity side? Just share a little bit more from that perspective. The reason I ask is because lately, there's been a lot of news, just around very large, successful venture capital firms actually shifting some of their strategy towards a little bit more hybrid model on the private equity side. So curious to get your take on that.
I'll be honest, it had to do with a lot of failures. I ended up, investing in a lot of startups that, didn't quite pan out, and a lot of that has to do with the power law, right? You have to write enough checks in order to see one of them hits. And, unfortunately, like my partner and I, we didn't raise the funds. We were using our own funds to kind of launch this syndicate and invest in founders that we are friends with and founders we believe in. But the problem with that is, of course, you know, it sometimes turns out that it could be not profitable. And that's what a lot of folks don't understand when they're looking at the venture side, right? If you are investing in startups, there's a huge risk that you're never going to see that money ever again. And so, you know, for us who are not a large fund, we really can't, you know, focus on doing that where we can just invest large checks. We had to be very strategic. So most of our strategic investments that did very well were not those, you know, tech startups, those B2B software companies, or even the blockchain companies that we invested in. It was these kind of like logistics companies, these manufacturing companies. Those are the ones that we're going to see the fastest and highest returns in the next 3 to 5 years. You know, one of them, like Granite Countertops, we're expected to see that one maybe exit in the next 3 years. And we were like, well, this kind of makes sense. And right now there's something called like the silver typhoon, where a lot of boomers are looking to retire. My dad actually owns an HVAC business, and he gets approached by private equity guys all the time to sell his business here in Miami. It's a very small family operated business. And it got us to thinking. It was like, well, there's something with that transfer of wealth that we should capitalize, and we use pretty much the same investment strategies that we did in the startup world for a couple of deals. Same thing, we used our own skin in the game, took out SBA loans. That also, I think, is the reason why there's a shift. A lot of people that are in HVAC, plumbing, automotive, those are industries that haven't been engineered or innovated for years. So someone younger, someone who's been tech, who's had to do that social engineering, that tech innovation to make it, you know, profitable. So
that's very interesting. I'm curious on the underwriting side. Obviously, in venture, it's all about the founder. We underwrite the founder. We invest into the founder. What are some of the learnings that you've implemented as now you underwrite businesses more on the traditional side? It's not so much probably on the potential or the upside. It's more specifically around what the business currently generates and what's in place. Tell us a little bit more about that process. What are some of the differences you see and maybe some similarities?
Well, there's a couple of similarities more than anything, right? So, you know, when a startup is doing their fundraise, you know, their whole purpose is to, you know, pay back the investors, right? So whether that's through some sort of IPO or exit strategy. In this sense, traditional businesses are very similar doing the same. And whether that's a flat out M&A that you're doing with them or a flat out purchase sale that you're doing with them, you as the buyer still have to act as the founder who is pitching themselves to one, the seller, the banks, or whoever else that you're going to bring in board, whether that's like an investment or partner. So a lot of similarities there, because you still have to maintain a very clean deal room. You still have to maintain very clean projections, and you still have to show that there's going to be a clear path to revenue, even though it's an existing business, right, when you take over the space. So now you're not only convincing the banks, your investors, but also the sellers to essentially, you know, do business with you, just like as a startup founder is convincing their customers and their investors to pretty much, you know, bet on them. And there's a lot of similarities when you're structuring deals, right? Maybe you're not using a safe or a convertible note because maybe you don't want them to get equity, but maybe you're doing something like what we did, a promissory note where it's just debt, you know, purely traditional, right? A lot of upside for the investor, a lot of upside for us because we don't have to give up a lot of the stakes that maybe a founder would do, but a lot of it, you know, translates, right? You're still pitching, you're still doing a deck, You're still putting in all this information in the deal room and presenting it just like any founder would.
So for those who are not closely familiar with that space, in terms of deal sourcing, tell us a little bit more about that process. How do you find those deals? You know, it's probably not as common as startup founders coming, knocking on your door and submitting pitch decks and, you know, fundraising. From that perspective, I would imagine it's a little bit more of a strategic, very hands-on analysis and, you know, the research that you have to do yourself, and then approaching that business in itself, probably, you know, another complicated element of its own. Share a little bit further about that.
Yeah, so I mean, a popular site that a lot of folks use is BizBuySell, right? You go online and there's a ton of folks that are pretty much, you know, looking to sell their businesses. I would compare this to a founder who is posting on, any crowdsurfing platform, you know, or Product Hunt, right? You just see a bunch of founders who are raising or who are launching something. It would be that equivalent, right? The biz by sell. So you would see all of these and you can filter through industries. You could filter through, you know, price point. So there's a lot of folks that even sell e-commerce business. So you can, it doesn't always have to be like a mom and pop, right? It could be, you know, an online business. I've seen a couple startups on there, shockingly enough, but usually on that platform, you're looking at, you know, maybe 3x EBITDA of what they're performing for the sales price. That's kind of like a standard rule. Anything below that, you're probably going to look at, you know, something that's not a good deal. Anything above that is probably going to be a very good deal. And that's like very simplistic, right? You would pick a niche that you're comfortable with or you have expertise in or something that you can improve, right? So when you're looking at a deal, right, for me, I like fitness. So the reason we went through this journey was I became a Pilates instructor, loved the gym that I was teaching at. And I was like, wow, this would be a great idea. You know, franchises for, you know, Solid Core, Tremble, Jet Set, they do extremely well. I honestly just did not want to start something from scratch. I thought it was easier to just, you know, purchase a failing gym or purchase someone who's retiring. They already have clientele in place, gyms in place. But when you start going through the process, you find out, okay, the reason they're selling, it could be, you know, they're going out of business, franchise laws change. They actually are looking to retire. They have other business endeavors, so they can't give the same, you know, business love. So your first step is to engage with those folks that are, you know, typically selling their businesses. You sign an NDA, you get a packet, and then you look at, you know, their 2 to 3 years of past financials. And that's where you can kind of decide, okay, does this make sense? Does the sales price make sense? Is there an opportunity to increase some revenue here? And then if all it checks all your boxes, that's when you start kind of going through this hefty, hefty due diligence process. And I'll be honest, it's daunting because founders, you know, they invest, they get a VC. You could probably close an investment in 3 to 6 months. These deals take, you know, 18 months to close, maybe even longer sometimes. So very, very different.
So what typically happens after the deal is closed? Does the owner or the CEO, the president, stay on, and do they kind of, there's a transition period, or do you guys like to completely, you know, take over from the very beginning? How do you guys usually structure that? Or do you form a board and you guys stay on that? What makes the most sense?
So it's very different for each deal. So some folks, you know, you would have to even start a completely brand new company. Right. Where it's a new entity, maybe new name, new kind of hierarchy. For some other deals, it kind of makes sense to have a transition period where whoever the seller is stays on for whether it's 1 month, 6 months. Sometimes there's things that cause the seller to stay on even longer. So let's say like seller financing, or some payouts that are due with performance. So this would actually cause like the team and the sellers to maybe stay on with a buyout period. So it really depends on like the deal, right? There's just so many ways to structure it, which gives a lot of freedom to both whoever's the buyer and seller to build it based on like what's going to be successful for both of them.
Makes sense. And then as you guys take over and start kind of implementing your strategy on operational efficiency and, you know, automation and all of that stuff, I would imagine, you know, with such a wave and growth of AI in the past couple of years, do you see also a lot of opportunity to implement something like this? Or do you guys take kind of, you know, iterative approach and, you know, don't try to rip off the Band-Aid and just go completely digital? How do you guys think about that?
No, 100% full AI, full automation. That's the whole point. I think what's important is, you know, I've taken over businesses before, and every time there's a transition of ownership, you know, you're going to have a loss of revenue, usually because transitions, there's a lot of things that you have to do, changes of vendor, changes of clientele. So you have to prepare for that. But the one thing that we are kind of being concerned, knowing from experience, is we don't want to change the front end for the consumer. And we want to quietly do all the automations in the back end, you know, seamlessly across the locations that we're acquiring. So that way, you know, it there's not a lot of friction, right? Mm-hmm. And if it's successful, right, and we can implement a lot of these digital AI processes that we're already planning on doing, then it's just a matter of copy pasting with every deal. And then eventually, you know, with this rollout strategy, just like you would do in private equity, eventually, you know, sell a nice package to, you know, someone who's interested in buying, you know, kind of like the bulk.
Yeah. And so what's the vision? Do you guys plan on completely flipping the business and, you know, get that to profitability and then exit that? Or is the vision that you guys will continue operating that? What are some of the things that you guys are planning as part of the acquisition process?
So what we've been thinking is at some point we'd probably want to, you know, raise a fund in order to, you know, replicate this at scale. You know, these first few kind of investments are trial and run. This is the ones that we're going to make mistakes on, or we're going to try to kind of hone in on how do we replicate this process. And once we get it, you know, set and ready, that's when we're like, okay, we're going to raise a fund and, you know, showcase like this is, you know, how we can, you know, 10X, let's say, you know, the business and whatever real estate comes with the business. Because that's the other thing too, with this acquisition play, moving from like, let's say investing in startups, they always have tangible assets, you know, in terms of this like real estate, which, you know, in my opinion, I like, because, you know, real estate's very safe.
I can attest to that because I, you know, a lot of our family personal portfolios, majority of that is real estate in South Florida. And that leads me to kind of further question in terms of kind of, I mean, on the asset side, it makes sense because there's a lot, probably a lot more cushion in terms of kind of risk management from that perspective. You can, you know, if everything goes wrong, you still at least have some type of a physical asset that you could liquidate and get something out of that. What are some of the things that you're preparing on kind of worst case scenario? You guys have gone through the full underwriting, you know, 12 to 18 months worth of work, you close, and then for whatever reasons, it doesn't work out. What are the different scenarios that you guys usually kind of prepare yourselves for, and what are the potential kind of outcomes? Because the reason I ask is, as you and I've been mentioning, startup space, it's, you know, it's a graveyard. Power law is real, you know, 9 out of 10 will not work out. But it's, you know, a lot of times there's nothing to, there's nothing left. But on the private equity side, traditional business, I would imagine it's a little bit more complicated than that. So share some thoughts around that.
So, and I think this is why, you know, we kind of move this way. It's less risky, right? Unless, you know, you lose, I don't know, more than 60% of your clientele and you can't replace them, right? These businesses are not going to go under. Most of these businesses have been operating over 20 years. They're long, stable, established, you know, businesses. And like we agreed on, right? The real estate component is very important. So leveraging, you know, the asset sale, that would be probably something that if everything hit the fan, you know, we would just kind of be like, okay, well, we got this million or so dollar worth building that we can just kind of liquidate if we really needed to.
Okay. All right. And then in terms of you mentioned, which makes a lot of sense to me, just kind of starting on your own, put your own kind of skin in the game, prove that model works, and then go out and raise the fund. Is that a similar approach as kind of what we do on the venture capital side, where we would just set a target? We work with high net worth individuals, institutionals, and things like that. Is that a similar process, or is that a little bit different?
It's going to be a little bit different right now, because for now, you know, we're trying to prove, you know, that we can do this, that we can acquire these businesses, that we can maintain profitability, and that we can do some, you know, creative stuff with, you know, the real estate as well, you know, by like maybe doing like a triple net lease to it, and, you know, kind of replicate that model. Once we show that we have that IRR, then that's when we would kind of be like, okay, we're going to do a fund in order to maybe perhaps get three or four more of these, you know, and kind of the key, just like in VC, is you always have a pipeline where no experience, nothing to show.
The picture is clear to me in terms of how that's structured, and, you know, especially validating the model upfront yourself and just kind of then applying that to more or less wash, rinse, repeat, that you now go in at scale where you can replicate that model and go try to acquire businesses at, you know, at large. Is the vision then you would manage a portfolio of businesses, and are you going to try to stick to certain specific verticals where you have kind of the most you know, muscle memory, I guess, from that standpoint, or are you guys going to try to diversify and just go in different areas? Because the reason I ask, a lot of times when we talk to LPs and potential investors who would, you know, want to come into our fund as well, diversification becomes, you know, an important conversation. But on the venture side, there's only so much diversification that you can do. I would imagine on private equity side, it's a lot more flexible. What are some thoughts there?
It's actually, you want to pick a vertical and stick with it. So we have been talking to folks who have done this successfully, and that's exactly what they did. They picked a vertical and they stuck with it, whether it was like, we're going to stick with just acquiring accounting firms. They hyper-focused on that one industry, and then, you know, they sold the portfolio. We actually know somebody who already did it in New York, where they, you know, took a bunch of auto repair shops, very similar to what we're trying to do. And they already exited with, you know, a successful hedge fund, and they have been kind of, you know, talking to us and giving us some, you know, pointers, because we're going down that route. So it's pretty much, you want to stick with a vertical that you know, and don't veer off from it, because then it's just going to become too complex. Whereas in startup land, VC land, you want to have that power law right here. Here it's different. It's like that power law is not in places. You really want to hone in on that niche.
I guess that's logical from a standpoint of just really, you know, proving out your model and then not, you know, the riches and the niches from that perspective. So I can definitely see how that makes sense. fitness industry you've mentioned, that's also something of huge interest of mine as well. And we actually, on the venture side, invested into a company which was founded by, you know, a founder who built, successful traditional chain of fitness centers. And then he found a niche that through AI, through data, through gamification, they can actually try to disrupt the fitness industry. And now they actually looking to launch their first studio in New York soon. They raised a successful round. So that's excited being part of that. But also it's, it's such an industry where, retention is such a important element of that, that if people are not sticking, people are not, because changing people, it's very, very difficult. I know you've mentioned Pilates and those things, and Exponential Fitness has been kind of one of the largest players in terms of the acquisition. You've mentioned the auto industry is the vision that you're going to try to do something in the fitness as well, or what's your thoughts there?
So for my partner, it's the auto. For me, it's the gyms. So that's the reason why. It's more of like I have a passion for, the fitness side. A lot of the folks that, I mentor or I advise on, their startups are usually in the fitness space. And mainly that's just because it's more of like something that I'm passionate about. And I think that's probably important too, when you're looking at, ventures, it's like what can make you money now, but then what also can fill your kind of soul. So I know the auto shops, the HVACs, like the plumbing, all that is going to pay the bills, but the fitness side, the fitness software, the wellness side, those, like you said, they can be a little bit more risky, but that fills my soul. So I'm willing to take the risk on those industries.
Hey, hopefully it's the other way around, that it's right. It's something that you experience with some massive exit. So I'm confident in that. As long as you have passion in that, I think that's a huge, huge component. Roxy, share what are some of the things that you subscribe to, the books you read and things like that, to keep yourself educated, informed, especially in your kind of space of, the private equity and small business acquisitions. What are some of the things that maybe folks you follow, or because it's a hot topic and it comes up a lot, and I'm curious about sources that really help you stay educated and ahead of the curve?
Yeah, so when I was going through this process, I really started focusing on the BizBuy book that really helped me, and I started kind of subscribing to a ton of newsletters and courses, the Cody Sanchez's and the Ben Kellers of the world, right? They all have a similar background, which is why when I started going through this process, I kind of noticed, it was very closed off to the typical, I worked at, Merrill, Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, and even my partner, he's a Wall Street guy. I don't come from that. My background is primarily, tech, high ticket sales. So for me, it was very strong learning curve. And so I actually started reading and started kind of learning just a lot of like investment banking, like manuals, just boring stuff, the stuff that you would, take an exam with. Just so I could understand the concepts. That really, really helped me more than, let's say, these kind of, zero to one books like Peter Thiel, just because if you understand the fundamentals and the numbers a bit more. I'm not a numbers person, I'll be honest. I'm more of a, go with the flow kind of person. And that truly helped me understand, like, the ROI of these businesses and why it was so easy to transition after that.
Okay. Well, that's exciting. Quite a journey, and I think it's also a very brave move as well, because it seems like a a lot of similarities, but at the same time, it's a huge transition, right, to go from VC to private equity side. So definitely congrats on that. I will continue staying in touch with you because I want to stay updated on some of the great things that are happening on the kind of other side of the equation in terms of traditional businesses and things like that. And we actually are planning a trip with a small group of entrepreneurs, business owners, and investors from this part of the world where I'm at right now, Central Asia. And they want to come to US, New York, Boston, Miami, and try to meet with some local players, local investors, and local, operators for some, knowledge exchange. So I'm definitely, looking for an opportunity to connect them with you as well. So I really appreciate your time today. It was very short and insightful conversation. And thanks for being so generous with the information you shared.
No, thank you, John, for having me. And then if they're in Miami or New York, let me know. I'm happy to show them our shops down in Long Island.
Yeah, that's definitely the plan. It's sometime in, probably mid-November.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, it's right around the corner. There's a group of about 10, 12, some very successful founders and business. Some of them are traditional business owners. So we're planning that right now, and I'll definitely, first stop is New York, then it's Boston, and then coming to Miami. So I'd love to, do some type of, meet and greet, grab a dinner or something like that.
Yeah, that'd be so fun. And then, I know Long Island's a little bit of a stretch, so we can always meet in the city. Lulu, stop.
Oh, right on time. You came in. Okay, well, this is great, Roxy. I appreciate your time. Best of luck with the move. I know it's I've done that across the ocean, so
yeah, this is easy compared to what you've done. This is a hop and a skip for me.
But the drive part is going to be fun because we've done that a few times, and it's I think that's a journey.
Yeah. We're going to take our dog with us and then fly back. I don't think she wants to be in the car too long. She loves flying, but, car rides might be too long. So,
all right. Well, best of luck. Keep me posted. And I hope to see you in a month or so in New York.
All right. Perfect. See you soon.